Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening.
Hey folks, welcome to episode 19 of A Small Voice. You can now subscribe in iTunes or download from bensmithphoto.com, not weekly but fortnightly. And in case you missed that recent announcement during a previous intro, the podcast is now every other week. If you enjoy it, please drop off a brief review on iTunes and do follow me on Twitter at A Small Voice Pod. This week I talked to Lydia Goldblatt. Lydia trained at the London College of Communications, receiving a master's degree in photography with distinction in 2006. Her work has been exhibited and published internationally with group and solo shows in the UK, France, Germany, Czech Republic, Greece, China, Malaysia. Her long-term project, Still Here, which she worked on over a three-year period, features images of her parents and focuses mainly on the subject of her elderly father's mortality, stemming, as she puts it, from a desire to address the inevitable changes wrought by his approaching death. It was published as a book by Hadjik Hans in 2013 and has also been shown in various international exhibitions. And if you're not familiar with that work, you can see a selection of images from the series at lydiagoldblatt.com. Alongside such personal projects, her editorial work has appeared in a variety of magazines, including those of The Guardian, Sunday Times and Telegraph newspapers. In 2010, she was nominated for the Sovereign European Art Prize, and in 2011 was awarded the Fondation Botin Residency Award with Paul Graham. More recently, she was a recipient of the Magenta Flash Forward Award and International Jewish Artist of the Year Award. And she's currently on a one-year artist residency in London where she lives. And I think that's where we started off. So enjoy the interview. Here's Lydia. Oh, yeah. So what are you doing at the moment? You're doing some residency, the Florence Trust. What? Tell me about that. What is it?
So it's a studio residency based out of a decommissioned church in Islington, which is great. The Florence Trust have been running for about 25 years, and they offer residencies to 12 artists a year. And the way it works is we each have a space within the church, and we get keys in August, and we do a final show in July, plus a midterm show and a catalogue, I think. And it's a combination of studio space plus crit groups and somewhat of a program of mentoring, and it's completely cross-disciplinary, so I'm the only primarily photographic person there, which is fantastic. Because it gives such a range of practices and insights into practice, and yes, really great.
So and how
cold
did, yeah, sounds good. And who's doing the mentoring then?
Well, there's the Florence Trust director, but they also have a board of trustees and a curator, and through that mix they get people to come in and do, it's not exactly a direct mentoring, but they get people to come in and do meetings with you and discuss work and kind of really try and support you in what ever it is you're attempting to explore or get done or experiment with.
Right. And so how did that come up? How did you get that?
I knew of it for quite a while beforehand. They don't get many photographers, I'm not sure if they get quite a few, but they don't. I don't know what the process of previous applications is, but I know that there's one or two photographers who've done it before, not very many, but I've known of it for a while, and I'd known of it partly through their work and partly just keeping aware of what residencies are available. But I decided to apply this year because I really needed some space and I needed a period of time to be able to make a new set of work that I've been attempting to develop over quite some while. So I put in an application and had an interview and got a place.
Great. So are you quite good at sort of keeping an eye on the kind of these things, you know, residences and even kind of bursaries and those kind of things?
If there are ones that I'm aware of, I'll try and remember to look at them with time, but I'm not brilliant at, I suppose it depends on what kind of phase you're in, whether you apply for them or not. So if I'm in a making phase, I might not apply for anything at all because I can't, I just need to concentrate on that. Or I don't know, it depends. I'm not brilliant at keeping up with them, but I remember to keep an eye out for them.
Yeah. So you're about to do this kind of midpoint show, right?
Mm.
What's the work you've been working on then? are you ready to disclose?
Well, this is a good test.
Yeah, this is your first opportunity to actually articulate what it is.
Yeah. Well, it's called Instar. And Instar is an amazing word that I read in a Rebecca Solnit book. And it refers to a biological state of change. So as a word, it has basis in fact, but also in a kind of poetry, which for me is a perfect combination.
Mm.
So this work is kind of about states of change and metamorphosis and a kind of shedding and growing. And it has reference to experiences of change that I've had in my life, but it's also kind of more general exploration of change as a catalyst for creativity.
Can you give us an indication of what the work is actually like? Let me ask you a different way. How did you go about trying to actually convey the themes, as it were?
I think I started making things before I understood what the themes were. So when I was making Still Here, for quite a long period of time, I was thinking about time and transition and change, but very much tied into mortality. And I really wanted to make something that explored all of those things, but the other side of it, so more about growth and kind of creativity. And that's where it started from. And I realized as I was making things that the two are intertwined and I can't really extricate one from the other.
Mm.
So that's how those ideas developed. And I realized that through some of the imagery that I was making.
In a way, you know, yeah, your process is that you kind of just, you start taking pictures and then figure out what they're about later.
It's a little bit of a mix because I do quite a lot of reading. Probably more literature-based than theory-based, but I read around ideas that I'm interested in. So I have a certain set of ideas in play, but it's pretty fluid. And I think it's necessarily fluid because everything I make changes along the way. And I've learned that. Like I did a piece of work a few years ago. I got a commission which from the Pavilion organisation in Leeds. And that took place over about 4 months. So I had to have very fixed plans because for me, that's a short period of time to make a piece of work. And I think I'm glad that I did it. And I think I made some interesting developments of ideas. And I made a video piece for that I think works very well. But I think also because I had to sort of pre-plan to that extent what I was going to do, there wasn't as much room for manoeuvre and openness in the work that I would have liked.
Yeah, so there's a kind of range of different ways that you can work and you can approach things. But I guess I'm trying to understand about, you know, when you're working from quite a kind of conceptual standpoint, as it were, how you then translate those ideas into actual photographs. So, yeah, this Instar thing. Well, what does the word mean?
It refers to a state of change in I think it's actually in insects.
Mm.
So it refers to a kind of shedding of a skin and a growing of a new skin. So it's very much a biological shift.
Mm.
And a metamorphosis, like very succinctly about a metamorphosis. But for me, it also has this poetic connotation, a word like Instar that has a sort of kind of universal and cosmic feel to it. And I think what I've been doing kind of exists both on the very small scale, but also has reference to cosmic iconography, like I've been making some very, very simple, basic drawings that I then photograph using. So the components are graphite, paper, and light.
Right.
And they visually end up looking like a kind of a silhouette of a mountainside or a constellation of stars.
Right.
Or a kind of possibly a atom explosion. I don't know what it might be, but these moments of shift and awe and change, I suppose. But they're made with very basic materials that are both drawn from the earth and are also the first kind of mark making tools that we have always used to express our creativity. So pencil and paper and light. And I guess what I'm doing is, with those, I'm combining them with straight photographs, by which I mean photographs that are drawn from the world. So the whole project is a mix of constructed images that I make and then photograph, and images that I find in the world. And for me, that works very well as a metaphor of creativity, which I think is an act in which you have to draw on both your imagination and what exists in the world outside you. And it's also the way we try and use photography as well, I think, to good effect. So right. There are some nice links there for me.
Yeah. Was it, did you say Rebecca Solnit was the writer? What was the book? Who is she? I haven't heard of her.
The book is A Field Guide to Getting Lost.
It's a novel or it's non-fiction?
No, it's not a novel. It's a exploration of some of her journeys, I think.
Okay. So I guess people can come to your halfway point show and see for themselves, rather than you having to agonisingly try to actually explain what the images are about, which kind of defeats the object in a way.
Well, someone asked me a friend of mine asked, what are the images of, a couple of days ago. He doesn't yet know the project at all. So his way of asking, what are you making, was, what are the images of? And I realised I was really fumbling to answer his question, because I was saying things like, a ball of string,
right?
A jellyfish.
yeah. I mean, that's kind of the question I should have asked, really, in a way. And then I like the, that's nice that we know that there's a ball of string and a jellyfish. But yeah, in what ways have you kind of, I guess, changed or moved on with this from what you've done in the past? Have you made a conscious effort to do that?
I think for me, there's quite a clear follow through from Still Here, but I think that most of the ways that I'm working with this project is sort of, they sit on the other side of how I was working for Still Here. So, for example, when I'm talking about my ideas and thinking about this continuing interest in time, transience, journeying, and love and loss and things like that, mortality, which was where Still Here was really based. This still deals with that, but deals with it kind of on the, a little bit more on the side of growth or creativity. Likewise, Still Here, I would say, was a kind of a mix of documentary and some images that were more metaphorical, a bit more abstract, symbolic, but it fell on the side of context and a kind of poetic documentary, whereas this, I think, falls on the side of maybe a little bit abstracted and constructed and metaphorical, with images that are recognisably of subjects. And I think part of the reason for that is that when I was making Still Here, I was very much grounded in a place and a set of people, and those people in that place don't exist for this project. And that was that project was based around my parents. My mum is still here, thank the Lord, and I love her dearly. But my dad died while I was making the project, which I kind of always knew was going to be a part of it. And that loss and lack of person, lack of embodiment, informs the making of this work.
Mm.
So I'm no longer making it in a specific place and of specific people. And I think that comes out through my lack of ability to say what the images are.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, let's talk about Still Here then, because, you know, this was a project which you became a book. It's a beautiful set of images. And it features, as you say, your parents. So, tell me a little bit about your parents' backgrounds.
My dad is from South Africa. So he was born and brought up in South Africa. He was born in 1917. And his parents came from Lithuania. So they left Lithuania during the pogroms of the beginning of the 20th century. I think that's right.
Yeah.
And went to South Africa. So my dad was born there and lived half his life in South Africa and then the second half of his life in the UK.
Right.
And my mum was born in London to German Jewish parents who fled just before and during the war.
Mm.
So they met when my mum moved into a flat and got herself locked out of the flat the first day that she moved in and had to knock on the neighbour's door to try and get access to it. And the neighbour turned out to be my dad.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So you got some fascinating family history there. I guess it started out, was it your dad you were focusing on initially and then your mum came into the project, or it was supposed to be them both from the start?
I think it was always both of them, but I had a different way of working with both of them. I'd been wanting to photograph at home for quite a long time, but it had been a difficult hurdle to jump, I suppose, to start photographing for various reasons.
Mm. What sparked the whole thing? Well, your dad was quite elderly. I was trying to do the maths here. Your dad must have been, nearly 60 when you came along. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was already in his 90s at that point when you started the project. Was it partly, I mean, clearly, you know, his age was a major factor. Was his health okay, or did you know that his, you know, health was not good?
He'd been getting, I think with my dad, it was kind of a slow decline. So it was something that we'd all been aware of for quite some time, but it wasn't a drastic ravaging illness.
Mm.
His health was certainly a factor in me starting to photograph. There was a kind of time imperative of what I've wanted to do this for a long time. If I don't start this, maybe I'll have lost my opportunity.
Yeah.
And I'd had little forays, I suppose, into starting to work with both of my parents before. For a start, I'd made them stand in for photos for me when I was interested in other ideas that I wasn't really conscious of how it related to them yet. But also, I think I'd done that classic thing of making oral interviews with my dad a while before about his life, which I haven't listened to, but I know they're there.
Right.
I'd sort of made other pieces of work that dealt in some way with aging, which I think was a roundabout way of getting to the core of my own understanding of that, which has to be through my parents.
Hmm. And how did they feel about it? What was the conversation? I'm gonna, like, you know, follow you around your house and kind of photograph your most intimate moments? Or did you kind of sell it? I guess you probably sold it a little bit better than that.
I don't think there really was a conversation.
No, probably not.
Because I'm a photographer, so I have my camera.
Mm.
I don't always carry it around. I'm not one of those photographers who manages to function on a day-to-day basis and look photographically and take photographs.
Yeah.
But I do have my camera with me, and it wasn't an uncommon object to be in the family.
Right, so they were kind of used to it in some way.
Kind of used to it, and I think I just started.
Do you remember, was there a particular point at which it became a project, rather than just you kind of experimenting and playing?
I think probably about 6 months after I started photographing, I dared to show it to a couple of people. And I hadn't before, because I hadn't wanted to think of it as work, because making it work was the thing that became too intrusive. So allowing myself to think that this is just a thing that I'm doing, and to play and not have an end in mind, felt more natural to me, and was very helpful to allow me to get going. And then I realized I did have a set of photographs, and I was wondering what they did. So I showed it to a couple of people, and I suppose at that point, if you show it to anyone, then it becomes something that's potentially work.
Did you feel at any point sort of uncomfortable or guilty or bad about the fact that you were, in a way, you're kind of exploiting your position as the, beloved daughter, because your parents will tend to, indulge you in a way. Did you ever, was there a point where you felt like you might be kind of, taking advantage of that fact?
I think both of my parents are pretty good at telling me if I've overstepped the line.
Right, good, yeah.
I remember certain points where I'd be really interested in something that was playing out, and I'd maybe want to make a photograph, and I'd kind of know it wasn't the right time. And sometimes I'd manage to know that for myself, and sometimes I'd bring my camera out and my mum would say no.
Yeah.
Or my dad would say no.
Right, okay, fine.
But I think also there are probably, in fact, I know there are photographs that I've made that I wouldn't show because they were a question mark for me when I was making them about how much I'm willing to reveal of my family and what's appropriate.
Mm.
And so I have to be able to judge that for myself, not only in the photographing, but also in the editing. And sometimes I think I've made photographs that I think I maybe needed to make to test out those boundaries, but I wouldn't show them.
Yeah, so you can make that judgment after you've taken them, because it's then down to you to decide what actually gets seen. And obviously, people who don't know the work can have a look at it. Some of it's on your website, but basically, they're images of. There's one of your mum in the bath. It's shot from behind. There's some images of your, various parts of your dad's anatomy, kind of quite close up.
Mm.
And then they're mixed in with some abstract, more abstract stuff. I was thinking about when you're incorporating those kind of abstract images into a project. How do you kind of decide what belongs, in a way, and what doesn't? What's just what? How do you decide what really fits? Is it about the mood, or is it thematic, or the way the images play off each other?
I think it's all of those things, but for that particular project, part of what those more abstract images was doing was giving a sense of time and relationship between the body and the environment. So there are a number of images of light, say, that repeat throughout the series and throughout the book, and I was very aware of a different sense of time for myself during that period, in a way, a sense of a kind of a time slowing down and a watching watching things more closely, observing in detail. And so this light that would constantly change but then come back around again in cycles was a really good metaphor of that, but was also something I was naturally drawn to. And likewise, I was thinking, I think I'm probably an uneducated philosopher, and I think that informs how I photograph. So during that project, I was thinking about, you know, a mortality in our bodies and how what happens and how we relate to the world in which we exist, and a sense of kind of a human duration that is held within a global duration or a land duration. Mm. And all of those questions were sifting around, I suppose, in my head and in what I was seeing. I think when I am thinking about questions or thinking about ideas, I tend to find them around me. I think I'm a bit of a magpie, and I cherry pick things that I see, little treasures from the world.
Yeah.
They end up becoming photographs.
Because I think, did the title change at some point? It started off as All Flesh Is, and then it became Still Here. How did that sort of happen? When did Still Here sort of take over?
I think this is a very good example of not showing your work before you're ready.
Yeah.
So I sort of had to title it because I'd started showing it. And I decided to title it All Flesh Is, which comes from All Flesh Is Grass, which comes from the Bible, I think. We should know that. I did know it once. I've forgotten. But it came a bit too... It became a bit too... maybe biblical.
Right.
And I wasn't really interested in that reference. I wanted something a bit more elusive, I suppose. And so Still Here eventually... I think I was having a conversation with my tutor... my old tutor from my MA at LCC, Wiebke Leister, and I was just having a conversation with her, and I was talking and said something Still Here. She said, well, that's it, that's your title. And I realised that it is. So I took it on.
Yeah.
And because I'd been quite, you know, not satisfied with how it had been named. I hate titling. It's an awful, awful thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a necessary evil. And I guess that's why you have working titles, because they are subject to change, and they do tend to change as the project kind of progresses. And I think there's probably millions of examples of that. And you mentioned that you kind of shot them in your parents in different ways. I was just wondering about whether the characteristics of your relationship with both parents were reflected in the way that you ended up shooting them, or in the differences in the way that you end up shooting them.
Yeah, I think so. I think with my mum, there's a kind of light and shade to the way that I photographed her, and sometimes a playfulness, and sometimes an almost a photographic standoff between us.
Right.
Which is reflective of our relationship, but also of her kind of the way she is in the world. She's quite active and darting around. And with my dad, there was certainly more of a memorialising thing going on for me. And also by that point, he was much more still and frail. So, and as time went on during the course of my photographing, that became... more and more present, I suppose.
Mm.
So it informed the way that I photographed him, and it also informed the way that he was with me. But one of the things that I really didn't realise when I started photographing was that at a certain point, when he was sort of between this world and another world, sometimes if I had the camera, it would be a way of him coming back to this world and having an engagement with me. And that was really not something I could have predicted, but a really very special gift that happened.
Yeah. How was he mentally? Was he still sharp in his mind?
He was both. Sometimes he was sharp. He had dementia.
Right. So that came and went kind of thing.
It came and went. I mean, he was a psychiatrist, so...
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I was thinking maybe he took a kind of professional interest in what you were doing as well. So
yeah, I think he was interested. He was very interested. I think his capacity for understanding what I was doing became maybe less as time went on. But he was interested, and I showed him photographs, and he... It was interesting. I remember showing him a photograph of Mum and showing him a photograph of him, and he couldn't recognise himself, but he could recognise Mum.
Right.
I know he was interested, and I know from his professional perspective he was interested, but eventually that translated into, I'm just proud of you because you're my daughter.
Yeah, of course. Which is always what it kind of ultimately, well, hopefully what it boils down to. Mm. And then, as you say, he did finally, eventually die... at the end of the project, or clearly that was, you know, after a point at which you'd been doing it for a few years. And I was wondering about, you know, did having done the project in some way help you to kind of process his death, or to help you with the grief of that, or indeed your mother? You know, did it have an impact on either of you?
Well, one thing I should say is that we're actually a bigger family than me, my mum, and my dad. So I have three sisters and a brother.
Wow, okay. I was going to ask you about siblings. So you've got actually quite a lot of them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't really speak for them.
No.
About how it, how they see it and how it affected them. I think I'm lucky enough to have had, I suppose, some loving feedback from them. And my brother, who's my dad's first child, so I'm the youngest, he's the oldest, and there's a big gap between us. He's a cinematographer and a director of photography. So it's interesting, when I showed him the book for the first time, he comes at it from both a professional and a personal perspective. So on that count, I think he could appreciate it, but it also gave him some separate views and insights into his dad. And I think I've had that thought reflected back at me from the rest of my siblings, but I'm sure it's not the easiest thing either. Nor is it for my mum. And one of the things I realised that for my mum, you know, she's the one who lives with the legacy of this, not my dad.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So at some point it sort of turned into a book project. Mm. So what was that process? How did that happen?
I started making a digital dummy, I suppose, a digital skeleton, for which I had non-digital contact prints that I kept laying out on the floor in configurations that would change and change and change and change. But eventually I came to a sequence and an edit that I thought worked, and I put them into a digital dummy with a skeleton of a design. And I wasn't quite sure what to do about it. Mm. But it came about, part of it came about really randomly. I got off the airport to go to Arles one year and didn't know where I was going, and asked someone who had an English newspaper, who I thought would probably be going in the same direction as me, if I was getting on the right train. And he turned out to be a very lovely publisher and was interested in what I was doing. His name is Robert Violette. And I showed him my prints because he asked me to. And he said, oh, this is good. Who are you going to speak to? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. I said, okay, I'm going to see Hatcher Kantz in a couple of weeks. I'll show them your digital dummy. And likewise, I know and I'm very fond of Nadav Kander. And around the same period of time, he very kindly, in a very supportive way, asked how my work was going, and I told him, and he asked me to send him the digital thing, which I did, and he was also going out to Hatchikans, who are his publishers, and he showed it to them. So between those two, I think I got very lucky.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's a nice example of a kind of random event in a way, and also someone who you knew. So there's a kind of classic two fairly classic factors in these things which came together. But you know, was it something? I guess a book was something you must have had in mind, or something that you had ambitions to do.
I think when I started, I didn't. But part of the reason I did a residency in Spain, which was run by Paul Graham, and part of the reason I applied for that is because he's such a master at bookmaking. And by that point, I was thinking about outcomes for this work and whether it worked as a kind of a exhibited body of work, or whether it worked as a book project, or whether it could do both. And I got quite a lot of insight from doing that residency with Paul on how I might develop it into a book project.
Mm.
So I think from that point I was quite consciously doing that, but at that point quite a lot of the work was already made. It wasn't finished then. Right. But it was made. So, I'm quite slow. My work tends to take a good 3-4 years to develop.
Well, that's good to hear. I don't think you're alone. So doing the thing with Paul Graham was obviously a very positive experience for you. Mm. What did you learn from him primarily?
Ooh.
And was it? I mean, part of it was about just the mechanics of doing books, presumably, but some of it was about actually perhaps shooting
pictures. No, I think this is probably the only residency with a run by a photographer where we were encouraged not to photograph.
Right, really? Yeah. That's interesting.
But we were all working with bodies of work that were in progress. So there was a lot of dialogue and conversation about our work and how to bring it to fruition, and what kinds of forms are appropriate for each body of work. So I think I learned to think about that in a lot more detail, and also to look at books, obviously, in more detail.
Right. Did you enjoy the process of doing the book? I mean, was it... how were the publishers? Were they supportive, or were they a hindrance, or...?
They were amazing in that they let me kind of do what I wanted.
Right.
They were so laid back that I didn't actually believe it was happening.
Right. So almost an ideal scenario.
Mm. Once it got to production time, they were very helpful. And that's fantastic, because obviously that was a massive learning curve for me. But I started working with a designer as well to make my skeleton into an object. Mm. With bones and flesh and skin.
Mm.
Between the designer and Hatchie Kentz and me, there seemed to be a really good dialogue, and it worked quite well. And every time we took something to them, they said, yeah, well, that looks good, fine, okay.
Mm.
Which was so strange, but great.
Yeah, that's what you want.
Mm.
And I guess if you had to, you know, impart any wisdom that you gained from doing it to someone who was about to do a book, what would that be? Can you think of any particular lessons that you learned?
I think I got that kind of reaction from Hatchikans, because I'd already put a lot of time into an edit and a sequence. So I really knew what worked, and when I showed, or when my digital dummy got shown to them, there were some skeleton design ideas which were just a skeleton, but the body of the book, the images, they sat together well, and I was as confident as I'm ever going to be, which is not very confident, but you know, I was happy with the edit and the sequencing, and I was happy with the spacing, the spacing between images as well. And I think it's wise to get to that point before you bring a publisher in, often, because then they can see where your head is at. They can see where you're going. And there's a kind of maybe a trust that happens at that point.
Yeah, it could be part of the reason why they did leave you alone, as it were, because you're kind of showing them that you've, you know, or at least giving the impression that you're decisive in your decisions. Are you not? Are you quite insecure about your sort of editing decisions or your...
It takes me time.
Mm.
I just take a long time over things, and I need to think about them and then put them away and then come back to them and feel if they're right. But I think it's also that it's partly that, you know, they could see that I could do something, but also they could see what the output more or less would be. They didn't have to make a leap of faith because I'd already done that for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember seeing the book for the first time? Was it an exciting event?
Yeah, it was very exciting. I mean, I was there on press making the pages.
Mm.
So we finished all of that, but then it gets bound and then it comes to you a few weeks later. So that was kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
But very exciting to see it when it arrived.
Can imagine.
I was very happy.
You did a couple of projects prior to to Still Here with a sort of religious theme. What was your experience of religion as a kid? Were your parents religious?
No.
So sort of secular, Jewish yeah. kind of upbringing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what attracts you to that as a theme, as someone who had a secular upbringing.
Well, I think firstly, I did a project on my MA called Keeping Time, which was about adolescence, and the project that I made after that, which was the commission from Pavilion, was a proposal that I put forward, which became a piece of work called And the Word Was God. So that was, in some senses, a follow-on in that it was still dealing with adolescence and coming of age, but looking at religion and ritual. And I was very interested in how we develop our identities and the performance of identity and how ritual feeds into that. And how much we, our characters are inflected, I suppose, with religions, whether they are ours or other people's, and how much they kind of fit within the structures of society, whether we subscribe to the beliefs or not. So there's also this kind of fascination with, well, how does ritual marry up with belief? Because a ritual is an external kind of manifestation. It's an action, and a belief is completely intangible. So I was interested in working with children and adolescents on that, because I didn't really know whether those two things would marry up.
Right.
At a level, at an age where understanding was still coming into play, still being developed.
Mm.
Whereas the rituals can be learned quite easily. So, yeah, I was interested in that developmental stage of identity and how ritual can feed that, I suppose. In terms of having a secular but Jewish upbringing, it's a confusing subject that I still haven't quite fully come to terms with.
Right, yeah.
And there's a
but interesting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's even if you have a secular upbringing, there's a lot of ritual in Judaism, whether you are a believer or not, you know. I guess the same in Christmas is, you know, Christian
absolutely.
Terms, you know, we all go through those Christian rituals at Christmas time, even though, you know, 90% of us are completely secular. I guess it's the same if you grow up in a Jewish family.
Well, yeah, but also that I think my Jewish family, like my parents' upbringings were markedly different in their approach to Judaism. So my dad, who was brought up at the, you know, in the early 20th century with a family who'd come from Lithuania, that was his dad was a kosher butcher.
Right.
So that was very different to my mum, who'd been brought up by kind of liberal Jewish Germans. And they then made a decision to, when they had children, to bring us up with an awareness of our Jewish heritage, but allowing us the choice when we were adults. So I guess part of this, maybe I haven't thought about this, is maybe that I became adult and realized that I had that responsibility to make a choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't really thought that through.
I'm wondering if you might end up exploring it at some point, you know, photographically, to try and, like you say, figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do. I think I do, sometimes as a subtext to what I'm doing, and in that project, obviously, a bit more explicitly.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a massive family history, and social history that I am a descendant of, that therefore comes into play in how I am thinking of time and identity and family. Like it has to. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get a bit of context. What in terms of early days? How did you even get interested in photography in the first place?
Quite late. So I think. When I was growing up, I was an ice skater.
Right.
Which probably explains the project that I did during my MA, which was with ice skaters.
Yes.
So I was very focused on that, and I skated competitively, and I loved it. And my non-school world was based around that. And I was also interested in books and in music and... not cool music, I have to say, classical music.
Right.
I loved art, and I did history of art as one of my A levels, but I didn't discover photography until after I left school. And I started at university. There was a camera club that I joined, or a photography club that I joined briefly. That I thought was quite fun, and then I didn't really do it again until I think I did that classic thing of going away somewhere halfway across the world and being so slack-jawed and open-eyed at what I was seeing that I needed some way of recording it, and I used a camera in play, but in probably in earnest for the first time. And that
where was that?
That was in South Africa. I went to my. We did a big family trip to my dad's, to where my dad was from, which we hadn't done before. So it was, my sister and I had never been to South Africa. My dad hadn't been back for about 40 years. It was a big trip.
Yeah.
There was a lot of family and a lot of eating.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what year was that? Where was South Africa in its sort of trajectory?
Maybe... 2000, 2001, right. Maybe 2000, I think. Something like that.
Mm.
I can't remember.
Okay.
I'm getting old.
No, you're really not. How old are you? 38? 37?
37.
Oh my God, you look about 25, would you? Seriously, I can't imagine you even close to that old. I guess, you know... Do you think of yourself as an artist who's sort of using photography, or do you think of yourself as a photographer, or is that a completely pointless, attempt at sticking a label on you?
So going back to your question about whether I'm decisive or not, it can change.
Right.
I think I mostly find it simpler to say that I'm a photographer. Because people can somewhat get their heads around what that means, although they usually have different ideas of what it means to what I think it means. But, I'm both. And sometimes how I think about it will change. And I mean, at the moment, if I'm with Insta, I'm doing things that involve paper and pencil, that involve objects, that involve... kind of little installations, and but that primarily translate into photography. So what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't really know the answer, but I adore photography, and I'm quite happy to be called a photographer.
Mm. Well, you've got a foot in both camps, as it were, which is possibly a kind of nice place to be.
Mm.
I'm wondering about whether, you know, the way that you're received or treated changes as to whether people consider you one thing or the other.
Of course, context is everything. Yeah. So if someone outside of the remit of photography and art asks me what I do and I say I'm a photographer, their first question will either be about their camera kit or about weddings.
In my case, it's more like they want to know if you photograph celebrities. I suppose that's the other question. What do you think it was about photography that appealed to you when you first started doing it then?
I think I was very, very naive when I started taking pictures. For one thing, at that point, it was definitely a taking pictures, and now it's more like a making pictures thing. I'm not really sure what it meant for me. I know it was exciting and a thrill, and it meant that I could look at things and, you know, make records of them in the classic way that one thinks of photography as making a record of a thing. And then I realised some while afterwards, like my degree was in languages and literature, and I realised that part of my approach to photography is quite narrative, not necessarily beginning, middle and end narrative, but there'll be an emotion that I'm trying to follow through, or there'll be a person, or there'll be a something, some kind of a narrative that I'm grappling with. And I think I relate to photography in that way. It allows me to make narratives.
What sort of influences did you kind of have, or did you discover any photographers who became faves?
Faves.
Yes, faves.
I mean, it's a funny question, because those things shift over time and you learn. There's so much still to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. And the stuff you like, you know, changes dramatically.
Yeah, changes according to what your interests are at the time as well. But I think there are certain people who have, since I've learnt about them, have stayed constant. And I guess one of those is Harry Callahan, who was working in the mid-20th century. And his work, he's extremely inventive with his own practice. So he covered such a range of subjects. I love his work, and I love his work with his wife. But I also like the abstract language that he incorporated into his photography, and the range and the experimentation and inventiveness that he had. But then I also love Nicholas Nixon, because his work, The Brown Sisters, is one of the most acute and beautifully realized evocations of time. And
right, that's a sort of study of some sisters over a very over their course
years.
Of their whole life, more or less. Yeah.
So his wife was one of four sisters, and he photographed them as a group of the four sisters once a year over, well, now it's up to 40 years. And you see those relationships changing somewhat through the photographs. You see them changing. When you see them together, it's incredibly powerful. It's such a kind of pure distillation of what photography can do to express time and to express human relationships.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Yeah, and that clearly those are some of the themes that you're preoccupied by, I would say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you did this MA. Did you have a strategy in mind for how you would earn a living? Are you a planner?
I think I'm a bit of a muddler.
Right.
But I started I think with the naivety of youth, I decided, well, I was assisting to start with. Because before I did my MA, I started assisting. So probably about the end of my degree, I realized that actually I kind of like this photography thing. And if I want to go into it in any way, I better do it now or I'll get cold feet and I'll never do it. But I didn't know anything about it, nothing. So for me, the best way to learn was to assist. So I called up everyone I knew to see if they knew any photographers, and then I called them up to see if I could assist right. them. So it started through that, and I did a fair bit of assisting. And then I got a portfolio together and did a couple of little independent projects and started taking them to picture editors. That's what I mean about the naivety of youth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that happens to a lot of us. And in a way, it's kind of useful because if you knew too much you probably wouldn't even attempt these things. And I guess the fact that you are sort of back to this sort of notion of what you are, what kind of photographer you are, the fact that you know have one foot in a sort of very tangible kind of camp, as it were, and one foot in a kind of more kind of conceptual camp means that you get to work because you can you get commissioned or something. Yeah. Who did you start working for initially?
Kate Edwards at The Guardian Weekend gave me my first ever job. I don't think she knew it was my first ever job at the time.
Right.
But she did. And that was incredible for me. That was such a massive leap of faith that she took in me as a young photographer. So my first published piece was for The Guardian, Weekend magazine, and then I kind of carried on from there. So I've been doing quite a lot of editorial work over the years.
Mm. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I really enjoy it.
It kind of, I mean, does it feed into your own work in a way? Does it help with your general kind of creative levels?
It both does and doesn't. Sometimes what I like about it is that I get way too stuck in my own head, and doing commissions allows me to get out of my head and focus on a particular subject and a particular person and go out into the world and meet them and kind of cover it to an extent. And that's brilliant. I love that. But then also I will get commissioned to do jobs that feed into my own interests. So then there's often fascinating overlaps or fascinating conversations that develop through the privilege that I have of going and meeting people and asking to photograph them.
Hmm. The other sort of area of is the kind of application of applying for grants and that kind of stuff and do you find that an important part of your practice, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to two other questions that you asked about the bookmaking process and advice that I would give, but also how I earn money. So the earning money bit is always an issue. And I do a mix of commissions and some teaching and my own work being the least
profitable.
Obviously,
even the word profitable is sort of over the top.
So applying for grants to support my own work, I think, is very important. And going back to the book thing, for people who are, you know, looking into that themselves, they need to look at the Arts Council and other grants that they can apply to, and that their work is relevant to, and find creative ways of funding, because the way things are with publishers these days is that they might part support you, but not many of them will completely support you.
Mm.
So yeah, it is important, and that means that it's important to learn how to structure your thoughts in an intelligible way for others to read, which is really not easy all of the time.
No, you're right, and it's a good test. It's important to be tested in that way, that you have to do that. What advice would you give your 20-year-old self then?
It's going to take a lot longer than you thought, so be patient.
Right. That's a good one. And your 30-year-old self? It doesn't even have to be photography related. It could be just life lessons.
Have a bit more confidence. Don't keep thinking that you should give up.
Have you been tempted to give up in the past?
I go through cycles of thought, and I fairly regularly come to a point where I think, this is all nonsense, I should give it up, what am I doing? It's rubbish. But having said that, I've not given up, so that must say something about my confidence in what I can do.
Good to know. Don't give up, Lydia. Would not be a good idea. I think that applies to most of us. All right, great. Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, me too.
Thanks for making the time to talk to me.
Thank you for asking me.
It's a pleasure. Is there anything I missed, do you think? Do you think we did all right?
I don't know. I probably won't listen to this because it will really embarrass me. So,
I think we did all right.